Thank you for that remarkable address, Harrison. I couldn't help but notice in one of the final photographs the curtain rod. For those that saw a documentary on Australian television suggesting that the Apollo missions were a Hollywood fake, could you please explain to us the importance of the curtain rod in confounding the skeptics' view that because the flag remained unfurled in a weightless atmosphere, that it was all a Hollywood stunt?
Well, I think the main reason those kind of people appear to say those things is they want to get their mugs on television. But let me just tell you how the flag was packed and then what we did with it. Everything we took in really to the moon was vacuum packed, one way or the other, just in order to minimize the amount of space that they took up. Even our parachutes were vacuum packed. In fact, they had the density of wood. And if you ever saw them, as we did at various times during the test programs and everything, you would think they would never have deployed, because they literally looked like pieces of red and white wood packed away in the spacecraft. The flag was much the same way. It was packed in probably in a volume no more than my two hands put together. And when we deployed it in various tests, we realized that in that environment, that weightless environment, our near-weightless, 1/6 gravity environment, that flag just was going to stay pretty much folded up and crinkled. So to make it look a lot better in the photographs, such as you've seen, that frankly was our purpose, to make it look good, we had a collapsible curtain rod that we put in the upper hem. And that held it out, so not only did it get rid of a lot of the major folds and wrinkles in the flag, to some people it made it look like it was waving in the breeze, even in a still photograph. Figure that one out. But at any rate, it was one of those things that seems very minor, but for us was very, very important. And by the way, one of the things that we did for our mission control friends, the first time Apollo 17 did it, was to take an American flag to the moon. And the flag that you now see in mission control, whenever they show it for the space shuttle flights and space station flights, is the flag that we took to the moon for the our friends in the Mission Control Center.
One of the photographs shows of the Earth from the moon, there were no stars at all to be seen. Where did they go?
The question has to do with why are there no stars shown in the photographs of the Earth? The primary reason, and the only reason, is that the camera and its film, along with the human eye, do not have the dynamic range, which is the term of art, to see both an illuminated Earth, our spacecraft, our lunar surface, and the stars. It's the same during the day, on a clear day, anywhere on Earth. You go outside, the stars are there, you can't see them. Unless you go down into a deep well, and then you can see some stars up at the well opening. Your eye is a remarkable optical instrument, but it's not that good. And nor are the cameras that good. And you just can't see them. Now, when we were behind the moon, and could turn out all of the spacecraft lights and not have anybody jabbering at us, which we did several times, you could dark adapt and see this magnificent field of stars, certainly better than you would normally ever get to see here on Earth, except in extremely high mountain country. I suspect people standing on the top of Everest have had a comparable view of stars if they were there at night. But maybe even during the day. I'm not sure whether that's possible to do or not. Probably not. It's pretty bright up there. But in addition to that, we could watch sunrises. And they are spectacular from behind the mountain, believe me. The sun has all sorts of activity coming, streaming out away from it. The zodiacal light, these streamers that come from various eruptions on the solar surface. And then just before sunrise, each of those streamers has this brilliant jagged blade of light right in the middle of it. And then, of course, you need to look away. You don't want to be staring at the sun too long, watching it rise in space. So the stars are there. You just can't see them because of the dynamic range of the instruments you have.
Next question.
Harrison, are you able to say anything about the sample that you were able to recover?
Well, I can give you... if you had several weeks, I could give you my lectures that I give at Wisconsin. And by the way, they're on the web if anybody wants them. Let me just give you a very, very short summary. That summary is that the samples that we retrieve from the moon, their analysis here on Earth, the additional data that has come from several automated or unmanned missions of the moon, Clementine, Lunar Prospector, and the like, have resulted since Apollo in a very detailed understanding of the history of the moon, a history that goes from about 4.6 billion years ago to the present, but a history mostly which was over at about 3 billion years ago. And the reason that's important to us here on Earth is that that's the part of Earth history that we have a devil of a time reading in the rocks of the Earth. We are getting a little bit smarter with that, partly because we have insights that we've gained from the moon, but primarily just because the Earth has been so active, volcanically, in terms of erosion of oceans and streams and the like. We just have lost that history here on Earth for the most part. And it's a very, very important part of our history because that's the time, that period from about 4.6 billion years ago to about 3.8 billion years ago when life was evolving on this planet. And we just, until we went to the moon, had no insight into what the history or what the environment of the early solar system was like during that period of time. And now we do know. The moon has told us that. What was happening on the moon clearly was happening on the Earth, but in a very water-rich environment. And those insights have been absolutely fundamental to a lot of the discussion we now have about the origins of life. And in fact, there was a conference in Hamilton Island when we first got here. There was the first couple of events that I had where this was one of the primary topics of conversation and of discussion. It was a so-called bioastronomy conference. And understanding what the history of the early solar system was and its impact on the evolution of life was extremely important to those kinds of discussions. So that's one of the things the moon has told us. In addition, the samples have told us that there are energy resources on the moon as well as other resources, which are going to be extraordinarily valuable not only here on Earth sometime in the future, but also to future space travelers. Just from the science point of view, the exercise was hardly trivial, and it is increasingly exciting to those of us who like to study the Earth as well as think about the future of human populations on this Earth and their need for energy. The question has to do with the contrast of the American program landing in the spacecraft in the water in the early days and the then Soviet Union landing their spacecraft on land. There are a lot of things that went into that. Yes, there was always a danger of a spacecraft sinking, and indeed one of the Mercury capsules did. Gus Grissom's capsule, as you may recall, did in fact fill with water and sink. On the other hand, the United States had a multi-ocean navy. It was a relatively convenient way to recover spacecraft. You could make them much lighter than spacecraft that you would want to land on land. We did not, in the early days, have the as large rockets as the Soviets did. We had not focused on that as they had. We ultimately, of course, with the Saturn V, had a rocket much bigger than anything that anybody else had. And that tended to make us look at how do we minimize the mass of these payloads. But I think it was primarily a question of convenience. The Soviet Union did not have a navy. They were a major continental effort. They were much more secretive than the United States. In fact, we weren't secretive at all about these recoveries. If the Soviets could recover their spacecraft in the interior of the Soviet Union, then that was their business and nobody else would know anything about it. They had probably more problems in recovery over land than we had in recovery in the oceans. The question has to do with any interest or activity in trying to create a preserve of the moon in order to keep it, I guess, for prosperity. There had been some proposals along that line. I hope they're not really very serious, because so much of the moon is going to be preserved anyway. The parts of the moon that would be useful to us in obtaining new energy resources as alternatives to fossil fuels and to meet the demands of developing nations, if not only not our own, those parts of the moon would be relatively small, quite small. In fact, we wouldn't even know that that was going on looking at it from here. And most of the moon would indeed be a preserve. It would be of scientific interest, but not of economic interest. And I hope that's the answer that we come to, if indeed that issue is ever raised. Right now, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, I think, is very clear in that although no nation can have sovereignty of any part of the moon, the resources can be extracted for use to the betterment of humankind. And I hope that that's exactly where we head. One, maybe two more questions.
Yeah.
Harrison, to what level of physical fitness were you asked to achieve before you're allowed to go into space?
Physical fitness, the question has to do with the level of physical fitness before we went into space. Interestingly enough, NASA left that to the discretion of the astronauts. But fortunately, they all had great discretion. They understood that you had to be in very, very good condition in order to withstand the strain of working on the moon. The suits were not easy to use. They were, in fact, quite difficult to use. There were other aspects of spaceflight where conditioning was probably important, and maybe some that we don't yet know how important it was. The only astronaut that I know of that at least publicly claimed not to exercise very much was Neil Armstrong. And Neil, I think, would mostly in jest, did actually say, I heard him say it, that he felt that we only had a finite number of heartbeats in life and he didn't want to waste any of them on exercise. Well, that disregards the fact that just the training is a lot of exercise. I think our primary conditioning was probably the training, even though we all ran and worked out and played squash and handball and things like that quite vigorously most days of the week. The training in that suit and some other activities was quite strenuous. And if nothing else, Neil got in shape just by the training that he had to do. And I think probably secretly he probably was doing some other things. I just have to tell you, about 2 weeks before launch, I was the chief scientist for the Apollo 11 mission. I was very deeply involved in the training and in acting as an interface between the crew and the scientists whose experiments were flying on Apollo 11. We actually took scientific experiments to the moon even on Apollo 11, which was more obviously a political mission. But I remember coming into breakfast, being at breakfast one morning in the crew quarters at the Kennedy Space Center, and Buzz Aldrin walked in with Neil sitting at the table, and Neil was sitting there, knew Buzz was about to get there. Buzz was a physical fitness nut. I mean, he really was. He probably overdid it. And Neil was standing there with his elbow on the table with a rubber gripper in his hand. He was just going like this. And everybody knew Neil didn't work out on a regular, at least we never saw him work out on a regular basis. He's going like this, and Buzz came in, and I never saw anybody get redder in the face than that. Here was Neil exercising 2 weeks before launch. He was starting to get
Last question. Yeah.
Were you constantly able to recharge batteries and recycle water? I mean, like, how long could you have stayed at the batteries so delayed coming back?
If we had had a recharge capability, electrical power, of course, not been a problem, but we did not have the capability at that time to extract the oxygen that we would need or the water we would need from the lunar materials. Future visitors to the moon will clearly, I think, will have that capability and will be able to stay indefinitely. We did not. Our lunar module, had we planned to stay 4 days on the moon, could have supported that. You would probably have to leave a little bit of the scientific payload back, but then again, I think the men were the most important scientific payload we took, and that wouldn't have bothered me very much. Indeed, in the planning, the early planning for Apollo 17, I tried to persuade the NASA managers that we ought to plan on four excursions, 4 days on the moon. But by then, people were getting pretty conservative, and the managers were, And they had their eyes on space shuttle program and things like that, and so that idea did not fly. But the lunar module turned out to have significantly more capability than we thought it might, say, in 1968, 69, when we were actually getting ready to fly it the first time. And it turned out it had about the capability that some of the very early design engineering said it could have, the design engineering done by the Grumman Aircraft Corporation in what was called a design reference mission. And that design reference mission actually conceptually had the lunar module as a four-day excursion module for the moon. So we basically got to that capability even though we didn't fully utilize it. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.